Welcome to another episode of Solutions. This series highlights the work of individuals and nonprofit organizations that seek to improve the quality of life in our communities. We discuss the daily problems that challenge our society and the solutions that have been made possible by nonprofit organizations. This series is produced and distributed by the Public Service Global Radio Network, a service of Prosperity Media, a 501c3 nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. I'm Eugene Miller, Vice President of Prosperity Media. This episode of Solutions focuses on poverty. The following is from the ATD Fourth World website. We hold a vision of a world without poverty, a society where each person is respected. Poverty is an affront to human dignity, and people in poverty have unique knowledge and experience that can lower the barrier separating people and communities. The violence of extreme poverty, ignorance, deprivation, and contempt isolates people and locks them in silence to the point where they doubt that they're part of the human community. Here are some thoughts of a woman living in poverty in discussing her environment and her optimism for overcoming her situation.
A lot of the cursing, a lot of the disrespect, a lot of the drinking, a lot of the drugs. When I moved into the projects, which is still right there in poverty, I had to threaten the drug dealers to leave my son alone because they would try to get him to sell drugs. It can get hard. It can get rough. But if you keep trying to reach for the positive, you can survive and you can breathe. And you can help somebody else to breathe. I'm still going to school at this age. I'm still trying to learn this. I'm still trying to be that. Because you don't have to give up. If I don't give up at my age, you don't have no reason giving up at your age. I don't know. Maybe I might get out of poverty one day. If I do, I do. If I don't, well, but I know I don't have to ever give up.
We're talking today to Dave Meyer, who is the Stop Poverty Campaign Coordinator for ATD Fourth World, a 501c3 nonprofit organization that fights poverty in the U.S. and throughout the world. Dave, when did you become aware of the fact that there are so many people in the world suffering from poverty, and what made you motivated to actually want to get involved in a poverty campaign?
That's a really good question, actually. I mean, I didn't grow up in poverty or background of poverty at all, far from it. And I'm sure, though, that there must be a moment in our lives when we all sort of see somebody sleeping on the streets for the first time. And you wonder, as a kid, how do you must understand that? Personally, though, I guess I look back to being in high school and volunteering at a daycare center that was in the South Bronx, that was at a hospital and worked with kids who had AIDS. And thinking about the lives that those kids had in one of the poorest congressional districts in the U.S., not far from where I was living in a much more well-to-do area. And I think that experience, I mean, I even think about those kids. I think about them almost every day, actually, and still think about them today. And I think, but for me, that sort of got me motivated and interested in sort of understanding poverty. And it was only maybe many years later, actually, when I went to an event organized by ATD Fourth World, that I started to realize that there were solutions to poverty, actually, and that there are ways that somebody from my background could partner with people in poverty and, you know, really help them to achieve a better life. And so that's been something that ever since then that I've, you know, involved in one way or another in trying to get that work done.
How do you define poverty, and what is the difference between poverty and extreme poverty?
Yeah, I mean, this poverty is something that is too often it has to be defined because it's part of our policy apparatus. And so we have to have a number on it. And it comes down to, you know, what your income is. I think in the U.S., the federal poverty line for a family of four is like $24,000 a year. For one person, it's $11,000 or $12,000, something like that. The United Nations defines poverty as extreme poverty as $1.25 a day. That's kind of a tricky measurement, obviously, because it means that there's no extreme poverty in places like the U.S. where few people actually live with $1.25 a day or less. Even the $2 a day, some people say, you know, it's arguments over how many Americans actually live with that little. I think what's really important, you know, for us as an organization to keep in mind is that poverty is about a lot more than just how much money you have in your bank account. It's a question of how long you're living with that much money, how, you know, a lot of us have been poor maybe while we were in college, maybe when we had our first job. But, you know, as college graduates, as people living on our parents' couch, we weren't really living in extreme poverty. And even the poverty we were experiencing was just financial poverty. It wasn't anything long term, something that, you know, a few jobs down the line, we were able to do better. Whereas, you know, when you see people even in the United States who are facing poverty that comes generation after generation, poverty that they're born into and that they're sort of condemned by so many different factors into living out for the rest of their lives. And that kind of chronic poverty, what we call extreme poverty in the developing world, that's really a different kind of poverty. And it takes a lot of specific programs and specific outreach to those people if we're really going to address the most marginalized.
President Johnson declared a war on poverty in 1964. Where have we come from that?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what exists today in our policy tools for fighting poverty, things like SNAP, the food stamps program, date to that time. And it is wonderful, I find, as somebody who didn't live through that, to look back and imagine that there was at one point enough of will and common goodwill in this country to have a war on poverty is kind of inspiring. At the same time, I do wonder if maybe the fact that we had a war on poverty, people think of it as something that was, you know, 50 years ago, and that there's still poverty today, if it hasn't also led to a sort of fatalism in some ways, that we accept that maybe poverty is just there and we had a war and we lost and it's still there. And I think that's kind of unfortunate because poverty is not something that can be fought in a one-off battle, a one-off onslaught, and then it'll all be away. It's something that really needs to be part of how we live and how our society operates. And we have to make sure that we're including people every day or in our lives even today, or else it's never really going to be totally overcome.
Let's talk a little bit about the human element for those who suffer in poverty. What is life like for them on a daily basis? What are some of the daily struggles that they confront?
There's all the obviously there's the economic aspects of not having enough money and wondering where your food's going to come from. People in poverty often have substandard access to health care. There's something like 3.1 million children die each year just from hunger because of poverty, basically. It's at that point, you know, to say that poverty is not violence is really difficult. There's a professor at Oxford University, a man by the name of Robert Walker, who did some studies on poverty around the world, and he published a book called The Shame of Poverty. And one of the things it really looked at was, you know, what is the unifying aspect of people's experience of poverty in different countries? And he found that, you know, if you talk to somebody who lives in poverty in Uganda, he'll tell you that for him being poor is that his house is he has substandard housing. And if you ask somebody in Norway what being poor is about, and he'll tell you, you know, living in poverty is about having substandard housing. And of course, housing in Norway and housing in Uganda are extremely different questions and extremely different issues. But there's a unity there actually to what they're saying. And Robert Walker in his book, it's called The Shame of Poverty, really brings that word shame as what it is to live through poverty, that it's a sense of not being good enough, of not being as equal to the people around you, even though, of course, we're all part of the same community. But that said, I think sometimes when we talk about the psychological and the practical aspects of poverty, we miss also on the strength and the solidarity that there exists in these communities. And I've, you know, from working with ATD Fourth World, I'm constantly just blown away by the intelligence, the creativity, the solidarity and the love between people living in poverty, and how many people get by in really difficult situations because of each other. And that's something that I think we all need to learn about, and we need to really take as a lesson, take it to heart.
I think that a lot of people don't think about the psychological mm-hmm. implications of poverty. We're talking about depression. We're talking about isolation, the lack of any kind of self-esteem, the feeling of hopelessness that people face every day. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think you're really touching on something there. I think it's important even to keep in mind not just that's part of the experience of poverty, chronic poverty, certainly, but that's also in order to overcome poverty, we have to address those things. And you can't just give somebody more money in their bank account. You need to make sure that they feel that they have a voice, that they're comfortable in speaking about their lives and speaking about their situations. Something families will tell us often, you know, is when they talk about the way that they live, people don't believe them. And after you've been told that you're lying, when you're telling the truth, after that happens a certain number of times, you stop talking, you shut up. And that's a normal human response. And I think that that's something which a lot of people, especially people in chronic poverty, have had to live through. And we need to make sure that, you know, we're addressing those psychological aspects. We're making sure people are included in order to overcome poverty, really. That's an important part of the work we do.
Let's talk a little bit about the children that are growing up in poverty. Can you speak a little bit about the things that they face in their lives?
I mean, that's such an important issue, I think, particularly here in the U.S. There was one study, UNICEF ranked the United States 34 out of 35 developed nations in terms of child poverty. I mean, it's really, I've seen numbers, 1 in 5 U.S. children go hungry at some point during the year. You know, it's a serious issue. It's not just a question of food, as the hunger question would suggest, but you know, how kids are experiencing school, whether kids are really having the ability to relax and play and create the way that childhood should be, this sort of innocent time, and how much time they're spending instead worrying about, you know, their families and stressing for their parents. All around the world, you see children working at a very young age and things like that, which can make a huge contribution to their family, but is also something that none of us want to hear children having to go through. Something which has been really important for the work that we do as an organization is particularly looking at questions of education. Because if you talk to parents, they'll always tell you that education is important for them. It's what they want for their kids. And yet when you look at schools, so often kids who come from poor backgrounds don't feel that schools are made for them. There's one little girl in New Orleans who told us that, you know, she felt that school didn't like her. I mean, it's a terrible thing that any kid should have to say that. And so I think there's an experience of kind of not feeling like you're included, feeling like you're made fun of for where you live. If you live, kids who live in a homeless shelter often complain about that. You know, having to kind of hide, and that growing up and not having the chance to just kind of be a kid is something that's really underappreciated and really tragic, I think. That's something a young woman who we work with in Brooklyn recently, who lives in a homeless shelter, and spoke recently at the United Nations. This was a few years ago, actually, spoke at the United Nations about her life. And she talked about exactly that, actually, how she felt that she couldn't have friends because she could never bring anyone home to her house because her house was a homeless shelter. But then also she couldn't tell them where she lived because people would judge her, and they would judge her parents really unfairly in so many ways. It's a hard way to grow up.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking to Dave Meyer about poverty, and we're talking about the role that his nonprofit organization, ATD Fourth World, takes in fighting poverty around the world. And we will be back in just a moment.
Hey, Dr. Phil here. You know, I help people solve difficult problems every day, but one problem has me stumped: childhood hunger. Nearly 16 million children in America struggle with it. Luckily, the Feeding America network of local food banks collects surplus food, giving hope to hungry children and their families. But they need your help. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back. We're talking to Dave Meyer, who is the Stop Poverty Campaign Coordinator for ATD Fourth World, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Dave, I understand that your nonprofit is active in fighting poverty in both the U.S. and around the world. Can you speak about the locations of the various campaigns that you have in the U.S. and in other countries?
So ATD Fourth World was founded in France, and our international headquarters is in France. We've been in the United States for over 50 years now, and we have teams in New York, New Orleans, Gallup, New Mexico, and Appalachia, southwestern Virginia, as well as teams around the world. We're present in 30 countries in Latin America, North America, South America, Europe, Africa, Asia. We also have a team of the United Nations in Geneva and the United Nations in New York, and other European institutions and places like that.
Tell me about ATD Fourth World. What do you guys do? What makes you different from other organizations? And the letters ATD, what does that stand for?
Sure. ATD stands for All Together in Dignity. It's sort of a name which I think really reflects where we've come from. ATD was founded by people living in extreme poverty who are working to overcome poverty and put themselves forward as partners in the fight to end poverty. ATD was founded in an emergency housing camp in France. And now, like I said, we have a presence in 30 countries around the world. I would say if there's one thing that maybe that we believe above all else, it's that people in poverty are excluded, and that the only way to really overcome poverty is to change that. And that's something which harms not just people in poverty, but all of society is missing out because these people are not there. We need their intelligence. We need their creativity. And so those are kind of the projects we work on is breaking down those barriers and making sure that people can be included.
Okay, so ATD stands for All Together in Dignity. But what about the Fourth World? What does that refer to?
Yeah, so the name originally came about actually in the 50s just as the term Third World was being coined, referring, you know, Fourth World referring to people living in the worst poverty. of course, today we don't really talk as much about the third world. We talk about the global north and the global south, but the fourth world is in the north and in the south, and there are people living in extreme poverty who are actually much closer to most of us than we realize. And, you know, that term extreme poverty is sometimes problematic. It makes a lot of sense in the context of the United Nations and international development. In the U.S., we tend to think maybe more of chronic poverty or intergenerational poverty or things like that. I think what's important to keep in mind is that, you know, we really focus on the people who are the most excluded and the people who are being left behind. And that's the fourth world. And those people are all over the world. They're not just in the developing world or anywhere else.
Now, you've mentioned rights a few times. I wonder what then ATD Fourth World sees as the solution to extreme poverty. I mean, I gather you're not running soup kitchens and food pantries, are you?
No, we don't do soup kitchens and food pantries, which is not to criticize the organizations that do. There's some fantastic people doing amazing work for those organizations, and far too many families, particularly here in the U.S., would be going hungry without food pantries and soup kitchens, which is unfortunate. At the same time, though, we can't eradicate poverty just by giving people food. Far too often, you know, charity, even well-intentioned though it may be, can actually become a tool to really reinforce exclusion. We expect people in poverty to always be grateful and to always be willing to accept whatever we have to give them, when in reality, we never ask them to give back, and they often have a lot to give if we're willing to partner with them. There's a quote I actually read just yesterday. The president of ATD Fourth World in France for a long time was a woman named Geneviève de Gaulle Antonios, and she was a member of the resistance during the Second World War, and she was in a concentration camp. And after the war, work became, you know, immediately identified herself with communities living in extreme poverty in France. And someone, a journalist later asked her, shouldn't we really just give these people a house and some food? And she said, you know, a kennel and a bowl is what you give a dog. What distinguishes a human being from an animal is culture. And I think that's really close to the heart of what ATD does in so many places around the world. You know, one example in Haiti, there's a neighborhood we work in Port-au-Prince, where we've had a relationship with them for decades. And most other NGOs don't even go there, considering it not safe. And we run a program called Babies Welcome, where parents can come with their babies and play and have a space where they can be creative and connect with their children. And there is a nutrition aspect to the program too, of course. Malnutrition is a tremendous problem in that part of the world, especially among children. But at the same time, a lot of the time is really just spent with parents having a space where they can feel safe, where they can relax, not being judged, and to play with their babies and connect with them, which is so important to child development, but also, you know, to being a happy parent. Any parent, I'm sure, would agree. Street libraries is another project we run around the world. We bring books and art activities to under-resourced communities. And so in places maybe like in the Philippines, for instance, that becomes kind of a literacy project where volunteers work specifically with kids to make sure they're getting the skills that they're not learning in school. And then whereas in the U.S., it's more about creating community and creating a safe space. People we've been in touch with for decades in the 80s in New York who grew up with the street library talk about how for them the street library was a safe space. It was a place that they knew that they couldn't go out and play on the streets most days, but when they saw the ATD Fourth World volunteers coming along with a blanket and with books, that meant it was street library time. That meant they could go outside and they didn't have anything to worry about. And creating that kind of a space where, you know, parents can come and be with kids, where a community can come together is really special. And there's even one neighborhood in Brooklyn, I guess, where on different sides of the road, people wouldn't talk to each other. It was for whatever reason, they'd had some argument and one side of the road stayed to its side, the other side, the other side. And actually street library in that community became a moment when the people could cross the street, one of the only moments people could cross the street and interact with each other. Another, you know, project here in the U.S., are also in New York, our team recently started a People's University, which is a space where people in poverty and people from different backgrounds can come together to talk about a given theme. We'll invite somebody maybe who's an expert in the conventional sense, who's an academic or a policymaker or a specialist. And then, of course, bring them together with people from poverty who are there in an environment and a space we can create where people feel comfortable expressing themselves. And people in poverty, of course, are really experts on so many things, particularly things relating to poverty. You know, and I could go on. We do painting art workshops, poetry workshops, literacy workshops. We do advocacy at the United Nations, lobbying at national, local governments, just accompanying families through helping them get, you know, birth certificates for their kids in some countries. It's a huge, wide range of things. Our projects are are so diverse because they're really defined by the communities living there. That relationship, the relationship with people living in poverty, is the key to how we function as an organization. And that's really who we are. We are a movement of those families.
Okay. You talk about maintaining relationships over time. How do you remain an organization with people in poverty at the heart of what you do?
Yeah, there are a few things that we do that I think this also talks to the question of, you know, what makes us different from other organizations. One, you know, is that the vast majority of people who work for ATD Fourth World are what we call volunteer corps members, which means that rather than just like a job that they're doing for a few years, they've engaged themselves on really a life path that includes agreeing to live in the communities we serve. They're paid a monthly stipend rather than a salary. They agree to move to different teams around the world every few years to share their expertise and their experience. And it really changes our relationship to the communities we work with. I think, you know, the best quote was a supporter of ATD Fourth World in Senegal who said that he knew when ATD Fourth World volunteers were coming because they had dirt on their shoes, and that most foreigners especially would come working for NGOs. They'd come in Land Rovers with the logo on the door, but that ATD Fourth World volunteers came on the bus and then they walked just like the local people. And so it's, you know, that's having the dirt on their shoes. That's a big part of what we do. And the second thing is that really we spend a lot of time consulting on a global scale and making sure that our priorities are chosen by the people we work with rather than the people who are donating. You know, there's an example right now. We're doing a research project on the multidimensional aspects of poverty. I'm trying to find out what people in poverty feel was a reasonable definition of poverty to go beyond this $1.25 a day question we talked about earlier. We've also done research to evaluate the UN Millennium Development Goals. We did another on the violence of poverty. And all these consultations and these moments, they really serve to inform the way we talk about poverty, the way we understand poverty, and also, you know, what our priorities are and how we work. And I think that's really important to who we are. And then lastly, you know, it's part of our DNA as an organization to some extent. You know, the founder of ATD Fourth World was a man who himself had grown up in extreme poverty, and he was working with families who were living in extreme poverty. Joseph Rosinski was his name. He was born in a refugee camp at the end of the First World War. He grew up and his sister died of malnutrition when he was quite young. He had to drop out of school, was supporting his family from the age of 5, was already working to get money for his family. And so, you know, when he started ATD Fourth World, along with these families in an emergency housing camp in France, it was really about, you know, giving these people, these families, the credit and the dignity that they deserve. You know, Brzezinski himself eventually became well-known in his lifetime. His 100th anniversary of his birth is a commemoration of national importance in France. You know, there are schools named after him and things like that. And that's really, we are so closely identified with him and his story that I think keeping that relationship with people in poverty is part of, you know, the center of everything we do.
What are some concrete examples of successes that ATD Fourth World has had in its work against poverty?
There are so many. It's funny. I wish sometimes that as somebody who works in nonprofit communications that we had a website where we could say, you know, like 40 people escaped poverty today because of our work. But, you know, the kind of, we work with the people who are the most excluded and we seek out people living in extreme poverty. And that's not an audience that it's easy to reach or easy to change things for. But there have been some really large scale changes. I mean, ATD was instrumental in the fight for universal healthcare coverage in France, for instance. Up until the 90s in France, healthcare was only available for people who were working. And thanks to ATD, you know, that was changed and healthcare is now available no matter what your professional status. At the UN, we were instrumental in the adoption of the Guiding Principles on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, in which the UN not only recognized that extreme poverty is a violation of human rights, but they also put together a handbook, which really gives practical tools for people on the ground, how they can ensure that the rights of people in poverty are being respected. Another example, which I really love, in Guatemala, ATD members there told us that their biggest hope for the future of their children was getting an education, that their kids could have an education, at the same time as their biggest frustration was that sending their kids to school, you had to pay for school fees and you had to have a birth certificate and a social security number. And so they couldn't get their kids in school. And so working with the families, we brought them to meet with members of the government. We partnered with other organizations and we were able to pass a law that made school free and made, you know, gave parents the right to sign their kids up to school, even without having a birth certificate or a social security number. And the result was that, you know, there's certain areas of Guatemala where they suddenly had 110% of kids enrolled in school, right? Because 10% of the kids who the government officially didn't recognize that they even existed were suddenly going to school, which is just like such an illustration for me of the kind of the absurdity of extreme poverty and the situations people find themselves in when they've fallen off the charts. But then also the potential that it has to really have a huge impact by making changes to even one specific policy.
On a smaller scale, what would you recommend someone do who wanted to take action on poverty today?
Yeah, I guess I'm supposed to say everyone should go sign up for an ATD Fourth World Team and volunteer and donate. And that's of course, very nice. But ATD Fourth World Teams aren't everywhere, obviously. You know, I think there's a lot to be said. One of the funny things about poverty is that it's something we all encounter, almost all of us probably encounter every day of our lives. Certainly, living here in the D.C. area, you can't go into the city and not see someone who's sleeping on a sidewalk somewhere. And that's, you know, how we interact with those people, I think, has a lot to do with how, you know, we address poverty in general. And maybe it's a question of just like going a bit outside our comfort zone. And instead of just looking the other way when somebody asks us for a quarter or somebody's sitting on the sidewalk outside the CVS and we come out, you know, it's really more about taking the time to talk to them, sit and see how they're doing. And as much as that might have an impact for them to be treated with respect, to be treated with, you know, the dignity they deserve. But it's also a change, I think, for us as people who are not living that way to recognize that these people are our co-citizens. And I think that, you know, those first steps of kind of getting out of your comfort zone can be really, really important. And, you know, and of course, there's also lots of policy questions and things like that. And, you know, people should keep in mind as we vote when the time comes that it's, you know, it's to support policies which will help people living in poverty.
So tell me, if I was interested in volunteering with your organization, if I wanted to find out more about the programs that your organization is involved in, because I know of people who are suffering through poverty, if I want more information about your organization, what you guys do, can you give us some contact information? Do you have a website? Do you have an address or a phone number that people can go to if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So, I mean, all of our different teams have their own contact. So the best thing to do is to visit fourthworldmovement.org. That's the number 4, then thworldmovement.org. Alternatively, internationally, our website is atd-fourthworld.org. And actually, you know, all throughout 2017 in particular, we're running a campaign raising awareness about these issues. You can also visit the website poverty-stop.org and sign the call to action and get involved is an excellent way to show your support for people living in poverty.
Okay. Thank you so much. I think we've learned a lot more about the people who are suffering through poverty. I think we learned a lot more about your nonprofit organization and what you guys are doing to try to fight poverty here in the U.S. and throughout the world. And you guys are really doing an unbelievable job in terms of trying to lift people up, trying to get them out of poverty and trying to put them on a road to where they feel better about themselves and they're able to raise their children in a comfortable environment. And you guys are certainly to be saluted for that. So thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today. And we appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another program in the Solution Series. We hope that you'll be interested in listening to future programs in this series, and you might want to check out our other programming on the new Public Service Global Radio Network, now available on SoundCloud. If you have any comments on this program, or if you would like to have your nonprofit organization featured on this series, you can contact us through our website at www.psgnet.org. That's www.psgnet.org. This program was produced and distributed by the Public Service Global Radio Network, a service of Prosperity Media, a 501c3 nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. At Prosperity Media, we believe that the power of media should be used for good. The music for today's program was provided through the courtesy of SJV Media. This is Eugene Miller on behalf of Prosperity Media, wishing you a good day.